8 Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and you're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, political pundits inaccurately predicted widespread Republican victories in the midterm elections, and we'll critique the media coverage and explore why we got it wrong. But first, our next guests are trying to expand our understanding about what grief is and what we can do about it, what different kinds of things we can grieve over. We can grieve the loss of a loved one, of course, but we can also feel grief over non-death loss, the end of a relationship, the end of a marriage, infertility or miscarriage, the loss of a version of someone you love due to mental illness, substance abuse. All examples, and perhaps you can relate to some. We want to hear what you think at 1-800-642-1234. How do you go about handling loss? Are you struggling with handling it? And are you able to recognize when you are grieving? Whether it's death or non-death related losses, what advice would you give to others? Join in the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us anytime, ideas@WPR.org. Our guests, Eleanor Haley and Litza Williams, are Baltimore-based mental health professionals and co-founders of the website What's Your Grief? Their new book is called What's Your Grief? List to help you through any loss. Eleanor and Litza, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having
us. Thank you so much.
Yeah, and Eleanor, I'll begin with you. We talked with you on Central Time about 3 years ago now about your online community that you've built. And what made you want to write a book about grief as well?
Oh, gosh. Well, in that time, something pretty big happened where there was an awful lot of loss. And I think we all know what I'm talking about. COVID happened in the past 3 years since we last spoke. And so up until around 2019, 2020, we had been, you know, writing in on our website, in our online community, doing lots of virtual stuff. And then around 2020, we were approached about writing a book, taking a lot of what we write about on our website and turning it into something that would be actually tangible in book form. And we had been approached over the years a couple of times and never really saw what we had to offer to the grief book space. There are so many different books out there. And so at that time when we were approached in 2020, I think we saw one gap in the grief book literature, and that was a book that would validate and normalize the wide range of grief experiences there are out there. At the time, people were, of course, experiencing countless, unfortunately, death losses, but also a lot of non-death loss, loss of job, loss of relationships, and the list goes on. And so we really said, you know what, I think now's the time. We've always recognized that non-death losses is a really big and important experience that needs to be grieved. And I think the world might be ready to acknowledge that as well. And so that's why we decided to take the step we did.
Yes. What's Your Grief? List to help you through any loss. And Litza Williams, why were lists a good framework to work from?
I think it's really interesting. We spend a lot of time talking about how complex grief is and how it's so much more nuanced than many people believe. And then to say we've written a book that's in the format of lists, I think is surprising to people. But one of the things that we know is that because grief is so overwhelming, it touches so many areas of our lives, so many people process it differently. Taking it step by step, one thing at a time, can really be an effective approach to trying to understand our own grief, to try to understand others' grief, and to find ways to cope with and manage the losses that we're facing in life. And so over the years, we had heard people come to our website who said, I picked up grief books and they were so dense, they were so overwhelming, it was too much, I couldn't concentrate. What I loved about your website was that you had these manageable, approachable articles that were sometimes in list form that really helped me to be able to find something digestible. And these aren't just like bullet pointed lists. They obviously are a little more complex than that. But we do think that this format for people who are feeling so overwhelmed and so overcome by the emotions of grief really does lend itself well to helping them apply and connect to their own lives.
And Eleanor, why do you think we have such a problem understanding our own grief?
Well, I think there's a lot of answers to that question. But one of the main things is that we grow up with a lot of beliefs and assumptions around what it means to experience loss and what grief looks like. And unfortunately, what we enter into grief assuming things will look like often does not match the experience. There's a lot of myths and misconceptions out there about grief. The number one that we always hear about is that idea that grief will be uniform, it will follow a set of stages, it will be linear, and it will have some sort of end point where we're expected to put everything behind us. And that's just not how grief works. So I think one of the things that makes grief so difficult is just it's very much an unexpected experience and overwhelming in ways we never anticipate. It's not just about feeling painful emotion. Grief impacts every single domain of our life, logistical, spiritual, worldview, relationships. It impacts everything. And people aren't always ready or expecting that experience.
Or are they even aware of their own grief?
Well, I think I would.
I'm sorry, Litsa was starting there. And Litsa, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, to add to what Eleanor said, yeah. I think that oftentimes they aren't aware of their own grief, or they aren't labeling what they're experiencing as grief, because they think grief only follows a death. You know, in those expectations Eleanor was just describing, I think one of the most fundamental expectations people have is just grief is something that happens after a loved one dies, and we expect that we will feel it then for sort of a finite period of time. And I think people are often really surprised to experience these other things in life where they have tremendous loss. And even though they feel it as a loss, they might not necessarily recognize that they're grieving that loss, and that it's appropriate and important to be able to label it as grief and understand that that is what we're going through.
That's Litsa Williams also joining us. Eleanor Haley, they are mental health professionals and co-founders of the online support group What's Your Grief, and authors of the new book What's Your Grief? List to help you through any loss. And if you have any suggestions or questions, you can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. We're Bill in Milwaukee standing by. Bill, you're on Central Time.
Hello, glad to talk with you. You know, I think that when we're in grief, and I agree with you, grief is not just for death. But whenever I've had to face it with my friends or with my own self, it seems that the simplest things are the best. I was watching The Hobbit just today, and Bilbo said, "When there's nothing around you but death, there's nothing to do but go on living. You know, what else can you do?"
Hmm. But that almost sounds like denial or rejection of grief, or just plowing ahead and ignoring your own feelings. You might want to stop and think about that for a second. And I'd be interested in your reaction, Eleanor.
Well, I think what that kind of resonates with in my mind is that sense of a little bit of a sense of maybe shock and numbness and uncertainty about where to even begin. And as the caller said, sometimes the simplest things are where we really have to start. And people often think that in grief, they have to have these really big coping tools and these really big deep dives into their emotion. And what we actually find is that grief is often about just taking things one little step at a time, day by day, and acknowledging that it's going to be a couple of steps forward and a couple of steps back. And that is what the grief journey, so to speak, looks like.
Litsa Williams, I would ask you, one of the quotes from your book, Viktor Frankl, an abnormal reaction to an abnormal situation is just normal behavior. How do you recognize grief? How do you see it, find it, identify it?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we try to encourage people to remember is that grief is our normal and natural response to loss. And when we look for that in ourselves, it can come out in so many different ways. It can come out in just thinking about how our identity is changing, thinking about after losses that have occurred in our lives, we may start to recognize, wow, I see the world differently. I used to believe that if, bad things only happen to bad people, or that if I sort of did the right thing, that the right thing would always happen. You know, I might see some shifts in my worldview. I might feel a loss of my self-confidence because someone in my life who was my cheerleader is not a part of my life anymore. And so it might be in these identity changes and role changes that we have. It might be in experiences where we just realize it feels a little bit more like anxiety because something has happened to us where we know the worst can happen now. We've lost a loved one. We've had, a devastating event happen, and suddenly we approach the world as feeling more uncertain than it was before. And we know that bad things can happen. So there's the things that people, I think, expect, feeling sadness, feeling, you know, those emotions. But sometimes it's looking for these other things that are important. It's sometimes knowing that when we feel numb, that can be grief too. Sometimes people will say, I'm not grieving. I feel numb. I haven't cried. What's wrong with me? And sometimes that is our brain's way of coping and sort of giving us the distance that we need from the emotions in order to function day to day. And that is part of our grief, is that numbness. And that with time, we might need to look for safe, comfortable spaces where we can, either with a counselor or with friends or family members, acknowledge the loss and talk about it and maybe start to let those emotions in a little bit. So there's no one way to recognize it, but I think looking for any different angle at which we might be responding to a loss that has happened in our life.
It reminds me of another quote. And Bill, you brought up The Hobbit. I'll bring up Mr. Fred Rogers. And this quote is directly from our guest book, What's Your Grief? List to Help You Through Any Loss. And Mr. Rogers said, there is no should or should not when it comes to having feelings. They're part of who we are beyond our control. When we believe that, we may find it easier to make constructive choices about what to do with those feelings. Yeah. And that's where we stand this afternoon with Eleanor Haley and Litsa Williams, our guest, Baltimore-based mental health professionals and co-founders of the website What's Your Grief? New book, What's Your Grief? List to Help You Through Any Loss. Why lists? Part of the coping mechanisms. And you can join the conversation as we look at signs of progress and coping at 1-800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guests about grief and coping with it? Our conversation continues next on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Rob Ferret, and we're picking up our conversation with Eleanor Haley and Litsa Williams, a pair of Baltimore-based mental health professionals, co-founders of the online support group What's Your Grief, talking about their new book, What's Your Grief? List to Help You Through Any Loss. And you can join us at any time at 1-800-642-1234 or email us ideas@wpr.org. And we've been talking about loss, both in terms of death and non-death related. And as you write in your book, that sometimes coping with non-death-related loss and non-death-related loss, grieving, can be more difficult than death-related loss. Eleanor, why is that?
I think it's just difficult in many similar ways, but in many very different ways. And oftentimes, I think Litsa already mentioned the fact that people don't always recognize that they're even grieving a loss. And if you yourself aren't recognizing that you're grieving a loss, it stands to reason that the people around you won't always recognize, validate, support, or give you the time and space that you need to grieve that loss. So many times people feel that their non-death losses are disenfranchised. They're not acknowledged. They're not supported. So they often end up grieving them alone and many times wondering, what's wrong with me that I'm struggling so much with this? I think another thing that can make non-death loss hard, especially when it's grieving a person who is still alive, such as maybe somebody who has a severe traumatic brain injury, dementia, perhaps somebody who's ran away, is just that you're doing two things at once. You're grieving the change in the relationship, you're grieving the loss, but at the same time, you're dealing with the ongoing stress and you're holding on to that hope that things will get better, maybe they'll come back to you. So there are just a lot of different dynamics that go into grieving a non-death loss that people don't always consider and people don't always offer or receive support for.
Litsa Williams, there is a quote from your book that has stuck with me as perhaps one of the most challenging things for those who are trying to cope with their grief. Sometimes you have to help people help you. How do you do that?
Oh, yeah, this is really can be a frustrating thing for people who are grieving. You realize people are saying the wrong thing, they're doing the wrong thing, and it can feel so frustrating because you just want that support. But sometimes people's instincts are wrong. People's instincts are they want to take away our pain. And so they start saying things like, oh, well, you know, at least you can have other children, or at least you're still young, you'll meet someone else. You know, they say these really hurtful things, or they say general, sort of vague things about how things will get better. And sometimes we have to do a little bit of educating people. And that can be hard when we're grieving, but it's a reality that people don't know what we need if we don't tell them what we need. So sometimes we have to spend a little time with that. And we have to think, wow, if I'm frustrated by my support system, if I feel like they've abandoned me or they're always getting it wrong, what feedback could I get them, give them to help them maybe understand my grief a little bit better and understand what I personally need? So being able to say to someone, hey, I know you were just trying to cheer me up when you said that or find a silver lining, but right now what I need is for you to just kind of be present with me and to understand that nothing is going to make this feel better right now. I just need you to kind of hear me or listen to me or be a shoulder for me to cry on. Or maybe to say, you know, I really need practical support right now. I'm really, really struggling with getting the lawn mowed and my taxes done this year and things my partner used to help me with. So that's the kind of stuff that I really need from you. I don't need you to keep, you know, bringing casseroles over or whatever it might be. So to give people a little bit of that feedback and guidance so that we can get, you know, what we need from other people and so that they can feel good that they're supporting us in the ways that we need.
And when people come to you with the best of intentions and you are able to redirect them, I don't know anybody that wouldn't be willing to redirect themselves as long as they're coming to you true, right?
Oh, absolutely. I think people want to be able to help us in our grief. They just often don't know how to do it. And it's hard to watch someone struggle and suffer. So we sometimes fumble through. Like, none of us got a handbook on how to grieve and none of us got a handbook on how to support someone grieving. So we have to be able to kind of communicate through it.
I am vigorously and quietly nodding. Let's go back to your calls now at 1-800-642-1234, where Jeff in Superior is standing by. Jeff, you're on the air with Eleanor Haley and Litsa Williams.
Wow, this is great. Thank you for this opportunity. I formed an opinion in my older years that there's different kinds of grief. So, for example, I can grieve for a person that I've known, a family member, things like that. Then that grief might be triggered by a memory or something. So, in other words, I don't know I'm feeling grief yet. But I've also found that as an American, as a community, I still feel like I'm grieving John F. Kennedy's assassination or Martin Luther King not being part of our country. So is it true that there's like personal grief and then collective grief?
Oh, wow. I feel as though you have read the book, Jeff. Eleanor?
Yes, absolutely. We can grieve for anything that we have an attachment to. And so it might be an ideal, it might be a worldview, and it might be a public figure. So absolutely. And we actually, interestingly, we have one article on our website that's, I can't remember the exact title, but titled something like, Is it wrong to grieve a celebrity death? And I cannot tell you how much traffic we have to that article and how many comments we have, because people are having that experience, but it's often, again, an experience that gets invalidated. So you are absolutely right. There are definitely different things that will cause us grief, whether it is somebody who is very close to us or somebody we're a little more distant from. And we're often surprised by the losses that really cause us a lot of struggle. And I just think it's important for people to understand that grief is, it's on a spectrum where there are big losses that turn our lives upside down, that shatter almost everything, it seems. And then there are smaller losses that are hard, but that we have support and ways to cope with and integrate more easily. So it's totally normal to experience loss and grief over these wide range of things.
Eleanor Haley and Litsa Williams are run the online support group What's Your Grief and the authors of the new book What's Your Grief, List to Help You Through Any Loss. Back to you now, Lauren in Algoma. You're on Central Time.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yep.
Awesome. Thank you so much for taking my call. And I just want to thank both the speakers for talking about non-death related grief. I think the biggest grief that I've suffered is a divorce. And it's so taboo to talk about how that's a grieving process. And my best friend recently went through one and she felt the same way. I mean, you grieve the loss of your past because that person has changed. You grieve the loss of the person because you can no longer be with them. And you grieve the loss of your future, too, everything that you thought you'd had. And I've had a much harder time processing that than I have, you know, the death of a grandparent, for example, where they're not there anymore. They passed peacefully, things like that.
Yeah, Lauren, I thank you so much for sharing your story. And how important is that best friend to you? And where do you think your coping process would be without her? No, I think I lost you. Litsa, what's your thought about Lauren's story about going through a divorce and finding this to be a challenge, but having that best friend there who's going through the same thing?
Yeah, I think we cannot say enough about how, especially these losses that feel disenfranchised, that feel like people don't validate them or understand them, when we can find someone to connect with who has that same experience and who is willing to talk about it and acknowledge it, that can be so incredibly helpful. It's one of the reasons that, especially for losses that are a little more invalidated, that support groups can be so helpful. If you're not lucky enough to have that friend who gets it, a support group can sometimes fill that space. And we do know that oftentimes with grief, you know, I completely understand, as somebody who has gone through, lost, you know, a lot of people really close to me in my life, I understand that there's this instinct to kind of protect the word grief for death-related losses. Because when you've been through that, people want to say, oh no, divorce, you know, it's not right to call divorce because death is worse, death is harder. You know, they're all different, like Eleanor said, and they're all on a spectrum. And sometimes when we feel like we can't use the word grief for divorce, we then aren't able to connect with people over that shared experience of feeling those exact losses that the caller described, the life we thought we would have together, these shared memories, our sense of self, you know, who am I now if I'm not a wife anymore, if I'm not a partner in this same way? Does this undo the past that we had together? You know, there's so many things to cope with, and it really does become helpful when we can label it for what it is and find other people to help support us through it.
Litsa and Eleanor, thank you so much for joining us today. Litsa Williams and Eleanor Haley are Baltimore-based mental health professionals and co-founders of the website What's Your Grief. We talked with them about their new book, What's Your Grief? List to help you through any loss. And coming up after the news, we'll talk to a media and politics professor about the election coverage this fall and why pundits were wrong about predicting a red wave of Republican victories. It was near unanimous what was going to happen on Tuesday night, but those results were far from the prognosticators. What's the discrepancy? I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret. News is next. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today. And coming up, a sequel to the smash hit Black Panther opens in theaters midnight tonight, nationwide tomorrow, but without the title character. And we'll talk with a UW Green Bay professor about the history and cultural significance of this comic book character and get a preview of the new film. Now, in the lead up to Tuesday's midterm elections, pundits predicted a so-called red tsunami of Republican victories across the country that would give the GOP significant majorities in the House and Senate. As it turned out, there was no such wave in most states, and the analysis now is that Democrats exceeded expectations. But who set those expectations? Where did those expectations come from? The results raise questions about how well the media covers election issues and where coverage can improve next time around. And you can join us with your point of view at 1-800-642-1234. What kind of media coverage did you consume in the lead up to the election? And did you set your expectations for how election night would go? Let us know. 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Our guest, Mike Wagner, professor in the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. He holds affiliations with the Department of Political Science and the La Follette School of Public Affairs, and he's a faculty affiliate at the Elections Research Center at UW-Madison. And Mike, welcome back to Central Time.
It is great to be here.
Yeah, it's not easy. You can't paint an election media with a broad brush and generalize across the board, but I know I'm going to ask you to do just that. How well do you think the midterm elections were covered by the mainstream and nonpartisan media?
I think there were some successes in terms of the mainstream media doing a pretty good job highlighting how the election count process works. And so saying, look, we're not going to know everything on election night, talking about why it is there are big dumps of ballots at these seemingly random times that aren't actually random at all, but planned out in advance. And so preparing voters for that, I thought they did a great job. There was a lot of probably too much coverage of the polls, and certainly a little too much leeway taken with the narratives about what to expect, or at least not grounding those in the evidence from which they came. And so there was definitely some ways many news organizations fell short when we think about the election coverage in that way.
Some headlines leading up to the election day on Tuesday. Democrats on defense in blue states brace for red wave in the House. A red tsunami watch. The Republican wave is building fast. Headlines come from the Washington Post, the New York Times, CNN, Axios, and Politico. But where did this narrative come from?
Well, it came from a lot of places. It came from different news organizations, of course, and more partisan and ideological pundits who comment on politics. But, you know, just because there are expectations doesn't mean that those expectations were crazy, right? The expectation was the Green Bay Packers would beat the Detroit Lions.
Those were the expectations, right?
And it wasn't a weird expectation. They almost always beat the Detroit Lions, right? So that's not weird to expect it. And if we just look at history in midterms, we would have expected 20 to 25 seats in the House going to Republicans, 4 or 5 seats going to the in the Senate going to Republicans as well. And that would have been enough to give them clear majorities in both houses. And so that's not just using history and not any candidate running for office, any issue, just using that as a baseline, that's a reasonable expectation. I think where coverage and the narratives fell short was to try to think about what is unique about what's happening now, one of which is our divisions are just further entrenched. And so there are less voters up for grabs than there typically are. There's less persuadable voters. And so that's one reason these waves might not happen in as large of numbers as we might have expected them before. Another is that there were really unique issues happening in this election that pushed back against this red wave narrative, most notably the overturning of the Roe versus Wade decision and the Dobbs Supreme Court decision during the summertime. That galvanized many Democrats and excited people who tend not to participate in politics or might normally vote for Republicans, but in this one case saying, well, I don't like what's happened here, and so I want to vote for candidates who are going to bring policies back to their own priors on the abortion issue. And so there were a few different things kind of all happening at once that didn't get as much of attention in the narrative construction of what we were expecting.
Do we in some way make the mistake of putting all media into one bucket, the pundits, the prognosticators, the predictors, and then the actual journalists who aren't saying this is what's going to happen, but are stuck to the who, what, where, and how.
Right. Most everybody does this. I'm a journalism professor, and I do this sometimes, right? We say the media, but there's no the media. There's not a meeting where everybody shows up and decides on what the narrative is going to be. And so, you know, there are lots of different kinds of news organizations, and then there are people with different roles within the same organization, right? There's some people who work for a newspaper whose job it is to report the verifiable truth, other people whose job it is to share their opinions. Same on television, especially cable television. And so we kind of conflate these different sorts of things. And in this particular case, it was both sides of both opinion and news helping to create this narrative that there was likely to be a huge night for Republicans that ultimately did not materialize. If we looked at just the polling, we would have been much more skeptical about the red wave claims.
But we've had issues with the polling in the past, and we've covered this on Central Time, that traditionally polling has under-predicted Republican results. And this
it did in 2016 and to a slightly less degree in 2020. And so, you know, it's not bizarre that news organizations would say, well, if that's what's been happening, maybe that's what's going to happen again. It seems to turn out this time that what was undercounted a little bit, but not much, were Democrats or younger, more independent-minded, but also left-leaning people. And so, again, not huge misses, right? Most elections have been within the margin of error of a poll, but most news organizations don't highlight that margin of error. They say, you know, Johnson is up by 3. Well, yes, but if the margin of error is 3, they might be tied.
And that gives you 6 points
right.
overall
That's
where
right.
that result could fall, which means for some of these polls, they weren't wrong. They were just within that margin of error.
They're estimates. Votes are the actual score, and polls are estimates.
Let's go to your calls now at 1-800-642-1234, where Stephen in Wauwatosa is standing by. Stephen, you're on the air with Mike Wagner, journalism professor at UW-Madison.
Yeah, hi. I was going to talk a bit to what you just mentioned about the polls. And Nate Cohn with the New York Times wrote a really strange article in my mind and September saying pollsters didn't correct for any of the mistakes they made in 2020. And so we should expect that they favor Republicans again. And that just didn't turn out to be the case at all. And it's sort of kind of silly to think that pollsters wouldn't try and correct for the mistakes that they've made. And so basically the lesson is that polling error is kind of random, is well within the margin of error most times. And to predict it is you know, just a complete guess. And so the media really should either trust the polls or ignore them completely. But trying to add on this sort of like the adjustment for past polling error just doesn't really work. And I think that really did drive a lot of the red wave talk, because the polls were pretty accurate this time. And it was really just the narrative that the polls were going to overcount Democrats again that caused us to expect a red wave that just never happened.
Stephen, thank you for the call. Pollsters have told me that they can predict what people feel about the issues, but they can't predict people's behavior, whether or not they're actually going to go cast a ballot. And that, to some degree, can be a challenge for predicting the outcomes of these elections using polls. Are we making a mistake in using these polls for election outcomes and the candidates?
Well, polls are a snapshot in time. They're not the same thing as an election. They tell us a lot of information about how people are thinking about an election, but it's just not the same thing as showing up to vote or filling out an absentee ballot. And I do think, you know, that Stephen is onto something with the comment about how a lot of the coverage said, well, the polls are really close, but we're not going to quite trust them, and we're all going to systematically not quite trust them in the same direction, which helped build this expectation about a red wave. When we think about polling error, we hope and we assume that it's random. Some research that looks into polling error has found consistently that we tend to be systematically underestimating people who are less well off economically. And so in 2016 and 2020, a lot of those were white folks who supported Donald Trump. But in 2022, these might have been more younger folks of more diverse demographic backgrounds who were a little bit more left-leaning, but also less economically well-off. These are folks who are just less likely to answer public opinion surveys, especially when they're conducted by phone.
And I've seen this with – I want to ask about the influence that candidates and political parties have over the media narrative, because I've seen this with political debates, with setting expectations. But do we also see this with election outcomes as well, trying to set the expectations so that it's not so shocking?
Parties definitely do that. You especially see that before debates, where you have this whole campaign season where the campaign talks about what a great candidate they have, and then a week before the debate, oh gosh, they're probably going to get killed in this debate because the other person is such a great debater and our person never gets to do it. And they always, there's this expectations game that kind of happens. And another thing that happens is that journalists are, you know, often trained to be skeptical. And so if the historical evidence is the Democrats are going to have a bad night, if the polling evidence is mixed and looks competitive, but with the historical evidence, and then the Democrats say, hey, we're doing great, the journalists might say, well, of course you're going to say that. You're trying to keep your voters happy. They're looking for motives. And then they might even become more reactive and more negative to that argument from one side. And so journalists might be sensitive to that. And of course, journalists are sensitive to being called biased. And so they, you know, and especially being called liberally biased. And so when Democrats say, hey, it's actually looking better for us, reporting that in an environment where we know that typically it should be a good night for Republicans, that opens reporters up to being called biased. If they had said, oh, well, gosh, you know, maybe it's not going to be so bad for Democrats, we probably would have heard a lot more complaining about the nature of the news coverage itself.
So would you say that part of this media narrative about the midterm elections on Tuesday was a conservative bias?
It's possible. I would say that most kind of mainstream news organizations' main bias is toward centrism and trying not to take sides, even when the verifiable truth is on one side
or the other. But did you try so hard that you ended up being on the other side?
That can happen. I think that can happen. You know, sometimes reporters are, you know, like the extreme example is, you know, you're standing out in a rainstorm and say, well, some people say it's sunny. You know, we don't want, you know, like those are things where journalists, you know, need to be able to make calls about the verifiable truth. But sometimes they're loath to do so for those fears.
Mike Wagner, journalism professor at UW-Madison, talking today about the red wave that never came to fruition. And we want to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. What did you think of the election coverage you saw this year? And what do you think was well covered? What do you think could have been done better? Let us know. 800-642-1234. After all, we're the media too. You can also email us ideas@WPR.org. Our conversation continues next on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret, and we're picking up our talk with Mike Wagner, journalism professor at UW-Madison who studies media and politics, with us today looking at how the media covered the midterm elections and where we could have done better. And you talked about past as prologue before, Mike, and I want to hear a little bit from the coverage of the PBS NewsHour on election night with Judy Woodruff interviewing House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. And here's the House Speaker rebuffing the narrative of the historical trends in that interview.
I have always objected to the presentation, the media thread that was out there. You can't win because it's an off year. So who cares? We have great candidates who have confidence and courage to run because they believe and they know why they're running. And they know that our democracy is at stake, our planet is at risk, but also that you win these elections on the kitchen table issues.
Mike, do you win these elections on the kitchen table issues?
That's one way. There are lots of things that matter, right? So from the very fundamental in terms of how popular is the president and how many seats do you have that are competitive that you have to defend and all of those kinds of things matter. But these kitchen table issues matter too, right? People care about the state of the economy. They care about whether they have a right to an abortion or not. You know, these are things people care about. And when the issue is really important to them, it can become a voting issue. And campaigns, of course, are trying to raise the importance of some issues in voters' minds, right? So like, for example, Senator Johnson wanted voters to be thinking about crime when they went to the voting booth, right? Whereas, you know, Mandela Barnes wanted voters to be thinking about abortion when they went to the voting booth because those issues benefited them in the election cycle. And so these issues definitely matter. They're one of many things that matter. And in a state like Wisconsin, where 20 to 50,000 votes can be the difference, 1% here, 0.5% there are deciding who wins.
Let's go back to your calls now at 1-800-642-1234, where Lisa and Madison standing by. Lisa, good afternoon. You're on the air with Mike Wagner.
Hi. You know, I just wanted to say that the media was right on about Gen Z showing up on election day to vote. I worked a campus polling location from 6 a.m. to close that day. And by 2 o'clock in the afternoon, we ran out of ballots and were having to use the electronic ballots until we could get more. And every campus location did have to request ballots. We were just the first to run out. But those kids, they waited up like a half an hour or more to register to vote that day. And then they had to wait for a booth to open. And it was just a constant flow of traffic from them. They really showed up that day.
I appreciate the perspective from where you were on election day, Lisa. And Mike, there were some things that the media got right, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the coverage about the importance of abortion, inflation, crime, the importance of covering how elections are tabulated and the rules about those things. Like, those are things I thought the news media did very well. And I would say that the national news I was checking out here and there on election night were also doing a very good job of reminding voters it's not that all of a sudden, you know, Evers swings into the lead or Michaels takes the lead. It's the votes are in. There's already a winner. We're just counting. And we're just counting until we know who won. It's not like a football game where somebody could throw a Hail Mary on the last play of the game and win the game. The polls are closed. The votes are in. We're just counting. And that's something I think the news media has done a much better job of explaining to people. Now, could they do a better job of explaining other fundamental issues in the election in the month preceding the election? Yes, they could.
Let's go back to your calls now at 1-800-642-1234, where Diane and Baldwin's on the air. Diane, you're with Mike Wagner.
Yes, I wanted to mention that I don't normally tell people who I am voting for. And the Democrats, I voted Democrats because the Republicans are deniers of the vote, you know, the presidential vote. And there's so many people that are angry about that.
Oh, I think we lost you there, Diane.
It reminds me of the of Trump. Reminds me of Putin. We have all this information showing that he has lied about things, and yet we put blinders on. Putin, he doesn't even allow his people to hear any of the outside information.
Dan, let's get a reaction from Mike Wagner. And one of the things I did not see were some of the conspiracies bubbling up on Election Day, although social media had some stories, but they were quickly rebuffed. There did not seem to be any of the big lie that came from 2020.
Yeah, here in Wisconsin, there wasn't very much of it. And what did begin to percolate on social media was quickly knocked down by local news sources. But the other thing that happened, right, was that, you know, late in the night, early in the morning, I forget the precise time, you know, Tim Michaels conceded the election. And so this is how democracy is supposed to work. He did the exact right thing. He waited until there wasn't a mathematical chance for him to catch up. He didn't need to concede when there was still maybe some opportunity to show that his votes in a particular place, you know, worked out better than maybe they had thought. But once it was mathematically impossible for him to come back, he conceded the election. And when that happens, when our elites, especially the people from our party, tell us that it's over, we are way more inclined to believe it. And so that's the kind of thing that we need to see more of in our politics.
Diane, thank you so much for the call. And so you and I are members of the media, but we have to be media consumers like everybody else too. So how do we go about being more savvy when it comes to political coverage? What can we do better as media consumers, Mike Wagner?
I think as consumers, we can give our attention to stories that are covering issues and give our attention to stories that are covering the performance of candidates in office. Attention is a valuable resource. Where I spend my clicks, where I spend the time with my eyeballs watching something or reading something, sends signals to news organizations about how they can market themselves to advertisers to, you know, help their bottom line. And so if we spend more time trying to learn about what it is candidates want to do and how effective they have been at trying to do it in the past, then we spend on what's the latest estimate in the polls and how are the aggregated polls on 538 making this or that or the other, making it look like I'm going to have a good night or my side's going to have a bad night, the better off we're going to be. But, you know, it's fun to look at those things. And that's the part of the problem, right? It's you know,
you go to the horse race. You can always, you know, go to the horse race.
There was this old Saturday Night Live sketch when Al Gore was running in 2000 and Daryl Hammond's playing Al Gore. And they said, all right, everybody, open your textbooks to page 245. You know, people, you know, need to learn about issues, but we need to find ways maybe to make that more exciting and help audiences understand how vital these issues are to their lives.
So the media has a responsibility here to maybe, the horse race is innately exciting, but to some way turn that and that excitement towards the issues that people actually go to the polls for.
That would be useful. But of course, we as people who use the news also have a responsibility to try to search out things that are going to help us understand how the world works better, rather than just looking for stuff that says my side's great, your side's bad, or stuff that's about who's winning and who's losing and why, which is not, none of those stories are useful to us anymore because the election is over. Whereas if we'd learned about how does Senator Johnson go about thinking when he's making a big decision, or what was Lieutenant Governor Barnes' success rate at getting his promises enacted into law, those things are still relevant once people start doing the process of governing.
Mike, what are you watching for in the media coverage now after the election? What are you looking for?
Coverage about who's trying to keep their promises and what is in their way or allowing them to be successful. Opportunities to find political compromise. Our system shares power across branches of government and across levels of government, and so it requires compromise. And too often we have sort of empty calls for bipartisanship, but not much in the way of actual bipartisan governing.
So how do you cover that as a journalist, though? You've got the soundbite. You got to use the soundbite or the quote, and it is the lip service to the fact, but how do you add the fact?
It's very easy to point out what percentage of time the votes in legislatures are down straight party lines. Would be something to say, like, this person talks about bipartisanship but votes with their party 97% of the time or 40% of the time. We know which of those things is the better, more credible estimate of who's serious about being bipartisan. So there's other evidence that reporters can bring to bear on stories that go beyond faithfully reporting what lawmakers say about their intent to be bipartisan or not.
If I made you the news director of a Georgia-based news outlet and you had the Senate runoff on the horizon, how would you be approaching it?
I'd be asking the candidates about their positions on a wide variety of issues that we've learned voters care deeply about related to inflation, crime, abortion, the practice of democracy, the war in Ukraine. These are things that people are saying they care about, and we should demand that these candidates explain their views and what it is they would do as a United States senator to advance the views that they have from a policy perspective.
Mike, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
My pleasure.
Mike Wagner, journalism professor at UW-Madison, who also holds affiliations with the Department of Political Science and the LaFollette School of Public Affairs. With us today to take a look at what the media got right and wrong in the lead up to this week's midterm elections. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent will be joined by the leaders from both the Wisconsin Republican and State Democrats. Look at their agenda going forward and what we can expect next in Wisconsin. GOP Chair Paul Farrow and Democratic Assembly Leader Greta Neubauer join Kate tomorrow after 7 on The Morning Show. Archaeologists say they found the oldest written sentence ever unearthed in Israel. It's 17 characters long, and what do you think it says? The sentence was discovered etched into a tiny comb that dates back to about 1700 BCE. The comb was made from an elephant's ivory tusk with teeth on both sides, one side thicker than the other, and the engraved sentence is so tiny that it could be easily missed, only 1 to 3 millimeters wide. And what do you think it says? The earliest known sentence was all about personal hygiene. It was also written in a way that is at once both succinctly instructive and hopeful. Quote, "May this tusk root out the lice of the hair and the beard." And it most certainly did, as researchers found the ancient remains of head lice in the teeth of this ivory comb. So I wonder if thousands of years from now, archaeologists will be digging up ancient plastic shampoo bottles and trying to decipher our 15-character sentence about personal hygiene. Wash, rinse, repeat. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.